It's me, Max Chair, and you're listening to Video Nasties. Thank you for listening. I'm sitting here in my car studio and just took a rip of some delicious LA Kush cake, and I felt the need to hop back on here and just start chatting you up a little bit. The episode yesterday was shorter. The newer episodes will probably be shorter. I'm running out of money. I'm getting depressed. I'm getting anxious. Trying to figure out tax shit, living on unemployment, not getting ads on this podcast, so I'm not getting that much needed income. Maybe I should just like start doing some deliveries or something. I don't know, it just kind of hit me. But then it's just like I'm using my car, so I'm using gas, and I would want to drive into Boston to make some deliveries because people around here are creepy. But I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing with my life. In a way, I feel like it's already too late. Like, I should have just gone to SVA, and now where the hell am I? But also, I'm doing it right. I'm gonna keep podcasting. I'm gonna keep writing. And today's episode isn't about me. Today's episode is about Mission Impossible 3. And it's also about a little-known actor that you probably have never heard of. His name is Bruce Willis. Ring any bells? Bruce fucking Willis. The great man, the great actor, the great action movie star has retired from acting. Apparently he has aphasia. For those who don't know, I love Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis is one of my favorite movie stars of all time. Die Hard was my favorite movie when I was 10. That was the first R-rated movie I ever saw. And I hope I don't start tearing up during this. I was obsessed with the Die Hard movies. I watched that original trilogy over and over again. And I was thinking about it last night. The first one's obviously my favorite. The first Die Hard is one of my favorite action films of all time. In fact, I think it is my favorite action film of all time. That's like what I think of when I think of an action movie, literally. Die Hard, the first Die Hard. So there's that. And then Die Hard 2 is just like a big step down, but it's my favorite of the sequels. And then Die Hard 3 is a lot of people's favorite sequel, and I can see why. Some people like it even better than the original. It definitely brought in like a racial commentary angle. It's more gritty, it's more street, it's more urban. And it's more, I don't really know how to say it, I guess socio-politically conscious. I guess that's how I would say it. It's kind of more 90s, let's put it that way. It's more black. And Samuel L. Jackson is in it, which automatically makes it better than your average sequel, I guess. Not that I have anything against sequels, obviously. The title of this episode is Mission Impossible 3. So yeah, Die Hard with a Vengeance is a dope movie. And that's maybe the first movie I ever saw Samuel L. Jackson in. That might not be true. I mean, I was certainly aware of him, who he was, but I don't think I'd ever actually seen a Samuel L. Jackson movie. So anyway, there was that. So that's like my first, that's kind of my introduction to Bruce Willis. And then my mom loves that movie Blind Date with Kim Basinger. So I think that might have been like the next Bruce Willis movie that I saw. And then I got into Pulp Fiction and my life changed. So Bruce Willis's performance as Butch in Pulp Fiction is easily my favorite Bruce Willis performance of all time. I think he's quite iconic in the movie. And I think he's amazing in the movie. I think it really is a subtle, nuanced, great, brilliant performance, and I think he's a talented actor, you know? And I think he has good taste. I think he did like a lot of good movies. And actually, oh, I don't have my fucking notebook. I wrote out a list. I was able to fill 2 pages with all the Bruce Willis movies that I like, love, want to discuss, are notable, are worth talking about. I'll have to run inside to get that. Yeah, I just took this nice hit, so I'm nice and toasted. I'm stoned. And I'm gonna go grab that, and then I'll be back on here talking to you. Thank you for listening. Peace. Hello and welcome back. It's 12:48 p.m. Thursday, March 31st, 2020. Today I'm talking about Mission Impossible 3, first of all, which I enjoyed. It's directed by J.J. Abrams and co-written by J.J. Abrams. It's the third installment, obviously, in the Mission Impossible series, and it features Maggie Q, who's hot as fuck. Philip Seymour Hoffman, rest in peace. And it features Tom Cruise, of course, as Ethan Hunt, Michelle Monaghan, Jonathan Rhys-Davies, Fing Rhames, shout out. Really good cast. And there's actually a scene where you see them, like, making a mask, kind of like building a mask and then putting it on, and, like, you see Ethan Hunt getting into the character of Philip Seymour Hoffman, whatever his character's name is. You see him getting into that character. And so it actually makes the whole mask thing kind of like more plausible, because it's always like in Mission Impossible movies, it's like, you know, obviously it's like literally the actor playing the part, and then they pull off the mask and it's Tom Cruise under the mask. And that's part of the fun of the Mission Impossible movies. And it was cool to see it play out that way in this movie, if a little unbelievable. And it's also kind of like nobody really gives a shit. You don't have to like try and make it believable. And I think Fallout is the best Mission Impossible movie, at least that I've seen. And certainly the best Mission Impossible sequel, and the only one I've seen in a theater since Mission Impossible 2, which I saw way back in the day with my mom, the John Woo one. And then the Brian De Palma one, the original from the 90s, I saw back in the day. I actually saw it as a kid, and it scared me, so I had to shut it off. We rented it. The scene where the dude gets fucked up in the elevator. I want to say it's Joe Pantoliano, but I don't think it is. And yeah, so saw the John Woo one in the theater. Probably the only John Woo movie I've, or at least one of the only John Woo movies I've ever seen in a theater. I think it is the only one I've ever seen in a theater. And then, so yeah, then there's Mission Impossible 3, which I watched last night, and then Ghost Protocol is the next one, Mission Impossible 4, and then Rogue Nation, I think, is the one after that, and that's the one I think that will end up being my favorite. I think that's the one, the first one with Christopher McQuarrie, I think, I'm not really sure, and then Fallout comes next, if I'm not mistaken, and then as far as I know, they just made two back-to-back. One of the reasons I was kind of in the mood for a Mission Impossible movie, one of the reasons I ended up watching it last night, was that I had listened to this interview with Simon Pegg, and he had said that they just made two new Mission Impossible movies back to back. He was talking about it. So I don't know, I was just kind of like thinking about it. And yeah, I ended up watching it. But the kind of the big news yesterday was Bruce Willis's retirement from acting, which I was just previously discussing. And so I was talking about Die Hard. Okay, so I got into the Die Hard series during, I'll call them the days between, so back when it was still a trilogy. So Die Hard, Die Hard 2, Die Harder, and then Die Hard with a Vengeance. Now, in 2007, we saw the release of Live Free or Die Hard, which I watched this morning. I watched a large chunk of it. I watched a lot of it. A large portion of it. I don't know, I think I've seen the whole fucking movie, but maybe not like the very end or something. I feel like I've never actually sat down and watched the whole movie from start to finish. And that was the case this morning, early this morning, whenever the hell I watched it, midnight, 1 a.m. I didn't end up watching the whole movie, but I watched a lot of it. I think it's like a really good action movie. It's really entertaining. I think Justin Long is funny. I think Bruce Willis is great. I think Mary Elizabeth Winstead is hot. Maggie Q again, she's a great villain. The weird thing about Mission Impossible 3 is Maggie Q doesn't have any dialogue for like the first 20 minutes or whatever, and then all of a sudden she starts talking. I like how in this movie she's talking in the opening credits. And this was released the next year, 2007, and I decided that that is actually a perfect double feature, Mission Impossible 3 and then Live Free or Die Hard. The only problem is maybe they're too long. I think they're both over 2 hours long, which is probably part of the reason why I've never actually finished Live Free or Die Hard. I don't know that an action movie should be that long. It's not a problem for me that they are that long. I love action movies, and I love long movies if they're good and if they warrant it. Speaking of long movies, I've been thinking about watching Drive My Car, the Japanese winner for Best International Feature Film at the Oscars this year. It's a Japanese movie, and it's on HBO Max, if I'm not mistaken. And Pitchfork gave a good review to the soundtrack. I don't know, or the score. I'm just curious about it. I've seen shots from it. It looks like it might be beautifully filmed or well filmed. I'm gonna check it out. It's gotten a lot of buzz. So that's Drive My Car, just a complete kind of side note. But there's also another movie in the Die Hard series, which is A Good Day to Die Hard, which people don't talk about a lot because it's supposedly a terrible movie. I don't see it available anywhere except to rent. I'm not renting anything right now because I'm saving money, but I will watch that movie eventually. As a diehard completist, I will need to see that one. I think it takes place in Russia, actually, and it involves his son, I think, as opposed to his daughter in the in Live Free or Die Hard, which was one of the things that worked, I think, well about Live Free or Die Hard was, first of all, Mary Elizabeth Winstead is hot as fuck. And then she's also a really good actress, and she's funny. She can play comedy, she can play serious, she can play action. So I just think that bringing that kind of femininity into the fourth Die Hard really kind of like gave it this different flavor. In the same way they brought, I don't know how to say this, blackness into the third one, or Afroism. I don't know how to say it, but. Without being offensive, but in the fourth one they brought in femininity, all and then also with Maggie Q as the foil, as the villain, the main villain besides Timothy Oliphant, who's kind of like the overlord villain. But then Maggie Q is hot as fuck and she's great. She has a great voice. She's great as the villain in this. So and then I guess maybe they brought some of the testosterone back for the fifth one. They hired a big white guy, wrestler looking dude for the to play the son, and they set it in Russia, and I guess I don't know. I'm imagining the jokes don't work, the movie doesn't work, it sucks. I don't know. Live Free or Die Hard was directed by Len Wiseman. I'm a little out of sorts today because once again I spent money. Once again my girlfriend is asking me to send her money, but I am saving money from here on out. I am not buying weed. I'm not going anywhere, so I'm not spending money on gas. I'm collecting unemployment. I'm not sending my girlfriend any more money. She owes me money. I know I shouldn't be airing my dirty laundry on here, but it's Video Nasties. It's my podcast, so I can say whatever I want on here. Talk about whatever I want. And I want to say thank you to the listeners. The newer episodes have been killing it. And yeah, I'll continue to chronicle my life, chronicle what I'm watching. I'm still looking for an apartment, still looking for a job. I've done my applications for the week, so I'm basically guaranteed unemployment for next week, which I'm gonna need and which I'll continue to save. I won't be buying weed for, well, my plan is for at least another week. Or at least until next Tuesday when I get my unemployment check. Probably will have to send my girlfriend money at some point in time in there. I'm not sure. I'm hoping she sends me money. She gets paid tomorrow, I think, or she's supposed to. So that's pretty much it. I'm just sitting tight, just saving money. From here on out, that's it. I can't even leave the house. I can't do shit. I can't spend money on anything. I just have to sit on my ass, collect unemployment, podcast, write, and read. And by the way, I've been varying my reading a little bit, changing it up a little bit. Like I said, I watched the Making of Dune documentary on Arrow, which I haven't quite finished yet, but I love it. It's fucking great. If you're a fan of David Lynch's Dune from 1984, which I am, in my case, I love it so much. I actually prefer it to the Denis Villeneuve one, the newer one, which wasn't a bad movie. I like the movie, but I love the David Lynch one. I really love it. And there's an interesting thing in the documentary where
they talk about the, I guess they're called the transporters or something, and they're in various stages of mutation, so they the more spice that they take in, the more they mutate. So the first stage is like what you see, the guy is like talking to the guy in the gold place. I'm not describing this well at all. And then the next stage is like partly transformed, and then the final stage is that thing floating, that like creature, that floating creature that looks a little bit like the baby from Eraserhead. So there's that, which I don't know if that's a Lynchian touch or I don't know if it's from the book. I read a chapter from the book last night or early this morning, and that was me varying up my reading from Only Americans Burn in Hell, which is the main book that I'm reading now. And yeah, the book is great, Dune. I love it. It's my favorite thing of all of it. Like, it's better than both movies. It's the original book, Dune, by Frank Herbert, the one where, you know, the place where it all started. That is my favorite thing in the Dune universe. So it's great. I'm working my way through it. I'm still like probably, you know, maybe a quarter of the way through it, maybe not even, but I love it. I just love the way Frank Herbert writes. It's just a great book. So, and a great science fiction novel, and an influence on Star Wars and decades of science fiction to come. So, after it. So, yeah, it's great. And the reason I was, oh yeah, and then I pulled out Yearbook by Seth Rogen. I'm going to read that next. The reason I pulled that out is that something in Only Americans Burn in Hell by Jarrett Kobach reminded me of it. And I'm trying to remember what it was. Kobach kind of like debunks something that I had heard Seth Rogen talking about, saying that he loved or something. So I was like, oh, I gotta read the Seth Rogen book now. Because Seth Rogen's just a chump and a stoner, but I wanna read his book. I know what it was. I know what it was. Speaking of chumps, Donald Trump. Okay, I'm sorry if this offends anyone that I'm even mentioning his name. I'm a little offended by myself that I'm even mentioning the name of the devil. But Seth Rogen was, I don't know, on a talk show, or he was giving an interview, and he was talking about writing a book, saying, you know, he was a little nervous about it, saying, you know, can I really do this? Can I write a book? And then he said he realized, or he had an epiphany that, you know, idiots write books all the time. And then he said, Donald Trump has written several. So that gave him some confidence, and you know, that kind of bolstered his confidence and allowed him to write this book, Yearbook, which I think is great. I don't think the book is great, but I think it's kind of funny and kind of interesting hearing about his upbringing and stuff. So I'm curious. I'm gonna keep reading it. I think Seth Rogen is kind of funny and just kind of like an interesting figure. He's a writer, so that's why I respect him. But he's also, you know, an actor, obviously, producer, director, you know, he wears many hats. So, yeah, I'll keep reading his book, but not until I finish Only Americans Burn in Hell and Dune. Just kidding. I don't know if I'll ever finish Dune. It's epic, but I will finish it at some point, and then I'll probably end up reading it again at some point. So, okay, so the Donald Trump connection. So yeah, Seth Rogen said Donald Trump has written several, and then I read this part in Only Americans Burn in Hell, again by Jarrett Kobach, that says that all of Donald Trump's books were written by a ghostwriter or ghostwriters, and he just put his name on it. So either Seth Rogen was duped, either he has misunderstood, either it was a joke saying, oh, you know, Donald Trump's written all these books, you know, nudge nudge, wink wink, he hasn't really written any of them. And who knows? I mean, he may have, you know, collaborated in some way. I don't think Donald Trump reads or writes. I think the man is illiterate. But, you know, it's possible he sat down with these writers and, you know, gave them some material, whatever. So maybe he does deserve some credit. So it's like, so Seth Rogen's actually giving him too much credit to say that Donald Trump has written several books. The truth is, Donald Trump hasn't written any books, according to Jarrett Kobach. Now, was Seth Rogen duped? Was he making a joke? Does he just not know? Is he kind of like playing the game when he really knows, like, oh no, of course Donald Trump didn't actually write any of these, but his name is on them, so I'll say Donald Trump has written several books, you know, to make a joke, to prove a point. And that was a joke that he was saying, you know. He's saying, you know, idiots write books all the time, Donald Trump has written several. You know, that was his joke. That's how I'm remembering it. I'm not, like, quoting it verbatim. Maybe I am, but I don't know. It's been a while since I heard it. Okay, let's get back to Bruce Willis. I have no idea how I got on a Seth Rogen tangent. So, this is my Bruce Willis tribute. By the way, he's not dead, people. He's not dead. He's just retired, like Daniel Day-Lewis. Except in Bruce Willis's case, he made a lot more movies. Probably made a lot more money. And he's not the actor that Daniel Day-Lewis is, but he's a bigger movie star. And I think he's a great actor in his own right. I love Bruce Willis. I'll always love Bruce Willis. And he's also, he did it for longer than Daniel Day-Lewis, and he's got, like, probably, like, hundreds more credits than him, or, like, at least 100 more credits than him, than Daniel Day-Lewis. I'm also not totally convinced that Daniel Day-Lewis will stay in retirement, although so far he has stuck to that. I guess he's cobbling now. He's a cobbler? I have no idea. Will Bruce Willis stick to it? I think he will. In Bruce Willis's case, unfortunately, there's a medical reason. At least that's what he told the press, or his people told the press, or what the press is telling people, which is aphasia, which affects, I don't know, memory, cognition, something like that. So, anyway, that's not important. What's important is looking at the filmography, looking at the life, celebrating this man who I consider to be one of the greatest movie stars of all time. All right, so let's look at this list. So The Last Action Hero, nope, and then I crossed that out, The Last Boy Scout. I always mix up those two movies for some reason. The Last Action Hero is Arnold Schwarzenegger. The Last Boy Scout is Bruce Willis. The Last Action Hero I used to watch on VHS as a kid. The Last Boy Scout is a Tony Scott movie, which I saw a large part of recently on HBO Max. I thought it was great, but I never finished it. Last Man Standing, I watched it a while ago. I guess I just thought of it because of the last thing. And then here we go, getting into the good stuff. So Pulp Fiction, my number one Bruce Willis movie and performance. Die Hard, my number two Bruce Willis movie and performance. And then Planet Terror would be number three for movie and performance. I know it's kind of an oddball choice, but I love that movie and I love Bruce Willis in it. And then from here, we'll kind of break from that. So Cop Out, the Kevin Smith movie, which I've never seen, which Kevin Smith has since complained about because he said that basically Bruce Willis was a dick. And I've heard mixed things about Bruce Willis. It's possible that he's a bad person, but again, none of that matters. We're just looking at the career here. So, and we're looking not even at the career. We're looking at the movies here, and he's made some great movies. The next one, Moonrise Kingdom, his only Wes Anderson movie. Then Looper, with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He made that with Ryan Johnson, 2012 released. Blind Date, my mom loves that movie. I think I mentioned that before. And by the way, Bruce Willis is almost the exact same age as my mom. He's born the same year as her, so that he's like my parents' generation. So he's always like a figure who I kind of looked up to. Maybe even as a father figure, a little bit. And again, I'm talking about him like he's dead. He's not dead. He's just retired. Okay, so now we're going to get into M. Night. So The Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, Glass, and then Split, which he's in the very last scene of. Spoiler, if you've never seen Split, which I love. Split is one of my favorite M. Night Shyamalan movies. Unbreakable is my favorite M. Night Shyamalan movie. Easily one of Bruce Willis's best performances and one of the best Bruce Willis movies. That would be number four, I would say, on the list. If not number three, actually, even above Planet Terror. So that's Unbreakable. And then The Sixth Sense is incredible, amazing as well. Armageddon, I'm not a Michael Bay fan. Then the Die Hard movies, of course. And then 12 Monkeys, Terry Gilliam. He's really good in that. And Brad Pitt is actually incredible in that. Death Wish. Bruce Willis made an Eli Roth movie, or more accurately, Eli Roth made a Bruce Willis movie. Eli Roth is a named director. They hired him for this remake with Bruce Willis attached. Maybe, I don't know the whole story. And Eli Roth actually hasn't given a lot of interviews specifically about Death Wish. I don't know how the experience was, but I know that two notoriously difficult actors to work with were both in the movie, Vincent D'Onofrio and Bruce Willis. Two actors, or I should say two people who I respect, who I both respect as actors, or I respect both of them as actors, but I don't know. I've heard that Vincent D'Onofrio is difficult, and then with Bruce Willis, I've heard mixed things. Like apparently Robert Rodriguez had a great time working with him. Kevin Smith did not. Now Kevin Smith has this theory that Bruce Willis respects writer directors, so like he works with Wes Anderson, he works with Ryan Johnson, he works with Tarantino, obviously. But that was kind of a different thing because that was early in Bruce Willis's career, and so he was up and coming, and then Tarantino was also up and coming. But Bruce Willis was a movie star at the time. I mean, he had made Die Hard years before. But anyway, same situation, writer director. So he respected Tarantino. Die Hard obviously is a different situation. That was like his first big movie, or his first movie, period. Possibly his first starring role. So then Moonrise Kingdom, Wes Anderson, writer director. I think I said that. M. Night, writer director. Same deal. Death Wish, not the case. Even though Eli Roth is a writer director, he did not write that script. As far as I know, he's not credited at all. So I don't know how that experience was. I've seen images from the set, and I don't know. Bruce Willis just seems like a creep, honestly. Even though I love him, like I said, as an actor and as a movie star. And then in the case of Cop Out, again, Kevin Smith, of course, is a writer director, but he did not write that script. That was co-written by two dudes who wrote a script called A Couple of Dicks, which became Cop Out. And Kevin Smith was hired strictly as a director on that. I think that's one of the reasons why he took the job, actually, because he was like, "You want me as a director?" Because he thinks of himself as a writer. So I think he was flattered to even be asked, and he decided to take it. And honestly, I think one of the reasons he took it was because he wanted to work with Bruce Willis, which is kind of sad considering what happened. I guess they butted heads the whole time, and Bruce Willis was like, according to Kevin Smith, from what it sounds like, from the stories that he's told, or I should say has been able to tell, sounds like Bruce Willis is a terrible person. I'll just say it straight up. So I don't know. This isn't about that. So Death Wish, Split, and then speaking of Robert Rodriguez, Sin City was actually before Planet Terror, and that would also be on that list. So that would be my top five Bruce Willis movies and performances of all time. Pulp Fiction, Die Hard, Planet Terror, Unbreakable, Sin City. Wait, that's two Robert Rodriguez movies though. I don't know if I can have two Robert Rodriguezes on the list. I don't know. I'll have to figure out another one. Maybe The Last Boy Scout? I don't think I like it enough, though. Anyway, so he's in Sin City, and he's also in the sequel, Sin City: A Dame to Kill For, which I did a whole episode on, playing Hartigan in both. And then he's in Fast Food Nation, the Richard Linklater movie. I think just in one scene, but apparently he's like really good and really memorable in that scene. And apparently that's like Bruce Willis the actor. Kevin Smith was talking about it, and he was like, "Yeah, the best performance I saw in 2006 was Bruce Willis in Fast Food Nation in that one scene. He's amazing." He's like, "So I know he can do it, you know?" And he's like, "You know, there are two sides to Bruce Willis. There's Bruce Willis the actor, and that's what I saw in that scene, and there's Bruce Willis the movie star, and I guess as a person he was shitty." Anyway, I'm gonna get down to the nitty-gritty here. I'm trying to figure out like a definitive list, and I just feel like I'm forgetting something, I'm missing something from the Bruce Willis canon. So I'm going back, Sin City 2005, and then I'm going back even further. So yeah, this dude has good taste. He's done, first of all, a lot of movies. He has 144 credits on IMDb as an actor, and a lot of them are good movies. Tears of the Sun 2003. I actually saw that movie. Not great. Level 9 yards. Siege, Breakfast of Champions. Oh, you know what he was in? Was and then Mercury Rising, The Jackal. That's a good one. The Fifth Element. Yeah, the 90s were great for Bruce Willis. And then oh, he's in fucking Four Rooms. That's gotta be the other one. He's in the Tarantino segment, The Man from Hollywood. Believe that's the Tarantino segment. Fairly certain. I've only seen that movie once, actually. Color of Night, I jerked off to that in high school. North, I remember that. Striking Distance, Death Becomes Her, that's good. The early 90s were really good for Bruce Willis, besides Hudson Hawk. So, The Player, apparently playing himself. Last Boy Scout, which I mentioned. Billy Bathgate, Mortal Thoughts, and then Bonfire of the Vanities, that's the one. That might be on the list, except I don't really actually like that movie. I just like that he worked with De Palma. Especially at that time in the early 90s. Blind Date, 1987. That's a really early one for him. Maybe that was actually his first starring role. Yeah, that was before Die Hard. Die Hard was 88. He was also in Sunset in 88 as Tom Mix. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the list is. He's got upcoming projects too. So it seems like lately he's just been doing like action movies, or he was just doing action movies. Basically just kind of doing like Bruce Willis movies, kind of repeating himself, no disrespect. But I feel like, yeah, kind of like he kind of had like a comeback. Not even a comeback, but he had like a, I don't know, a renewed respectability in 2012. Like 2012, for whatever reason, was a really good year for Bruce Willis because he had Moonrise Kingdom and he also had Looper, which both did well at the box office, both got good reviews. He was good in both of them, particularly in Moonrise Kingdom. I thought he was very good in that. Probably one of his best performances ever, actually. And then, I don't know. So yeah, he had that, and then before that it was like the Die Hard thing, so that was like, I don't know, it was like, I don't know, Bruce Willis was awesome basically up until 2012, and then 2012 actually could have been like the start of like a more kind of like art house career for him, but then that never happened. He just like did action movies for the rest of his career. And not even good action movies, like shitty, like I don't know, I guess Die Hard ripoff action movies. I don't know. I don't know what really happened with Bruce Willis. He's had an interesting career, and I love the man. I love the movies. I don't know if I love the man. I've never met him. And if I ever did meet him, I would probably hate the man. He would probably be a total dick. But I love the movies. I love Bruce Willis as a movie star and as an actor. I love some of his movies. He's done a lot of movies, and I think that a number of them are good. And yeah, I mean, I really don't have much more to say, I guess. All right, so maybe I'll try to do the list here. In terms of Bruce Willis performances, I don't know. Top five, not in order, would be Unbreakable, The Sixth Sense, Pulp Fiction, Die Hard, Moonrise Kingdom, maybe. Just objectively looking at it, saying these are his best performances. He's really good in Looper too. I think he's really good in Planet Terror, but that's more of like a cameo kind of situation. He's really good in 12 Monkeys too, although I think Brad Pitt upstages him. He's really good in Sin City. So top five Bruce Willis movies. All right, so if I'm not repeating directors, I don't like to repeat directors on a list, except in that one I repeated M. Night, but he's just so fucking good in Sixth Sense and Unbreakable. They were on like such a kick with those two movies. So anyway, that's debatable, and like I said, those are interchangeable. But if I'm saying my top five favorite Bruce Willis movies, or I guess my top five movies that Bruce Willis has been in, if I'm just being straight up about it, in no particular order, Except for the top two. Number one, Pulp Fiction. Number two, Die Hard. Always and Forever. Those will be the top two. Number three. Gotta go with Planet Terror. Number four, Unbreakable. And then I don't have a number five. Did I see one on there? Death Wish? I didn't even really like it that much. I don't know. And then for the performances, you know what? Pulp Fiction, favorite performance. Die Hard, second favorite performance. Then Unbreakable, third favorite performance. Then The Sixth Sense, then Moonrise Kingdom. Except Sin City may be on there. Sixth Sense might even be better than Unbreakable. I've seen Unbreakable more than The Sixth Sense and more recently. So, I don't know. This is tough. As you can see, it's tough. It's a tough list. It's tough with somebody as great as Bruce Willis. But that's pretty much gonna do it, I think, for my Bruce Willis tribute right now. I don't know what I'm gonna do now. I need to type some stuff up. I need to call the IRS. And yeah, as always, I need to get writing done and I need to do some reading, so I'm doing me. I'm gonna smoke a little bit. I'm gonna try to get in touch with the IRS. Actually, before I smoke a little more. And I'm gonna sign off from this episode. So I want to say thank you so much for listening. My name is Maxwell Haddad. I finally listened to Heartworms by The Shins, which is their latest album, even though it was released 5 years ago. The album's dope. I prefer it to Port of Morrow, even though Port of Morrow is perhaps objectively a better album. So listen to Heartworms if you never listened to it. And I guess then they also put out a remix album the next year, 2018. Heartworms was 2017. So I haven't heard that yet. But yeah, that's what I've been listening to. That, and then I was gonna listen to this band Caroline. I just thought of it. Oh, I've also been checking out that band Wet Leg. They're not bad. I watched their videos today, and I was listening to Self Esteem. If you've been listening to the pod, you'll remember that I mentioned this song or this album called Prioritize Pleasure. Well, that's her, that's Self Esteem. She's this British white lady who records and performs under the moniker Self Esteem. So check out her album if you haven't. Yeah, here it is. The album is called her previous album is called Compliments Please, but her latest album from last year is called Prioritize Pleasure. And there's also a song on there called Prioritize Pleasure, and a song on there also called I Do This All the Time, which is, I think, a pretty well-known song within certain circles, perhaps more so in England. It's a pretty good song. I'm Fine. I like the end of that. I think the end of I'm Fine is like my favorite part of the whole album. I like Moody. I just heard that one last. And then I have listened to this whole album, if I'm not mistaken, but I'm kind of going through and listening to it again, checking it out. She was on the Elton John radio show, and I was looking at his lineup for some reason. Oh, maybe because he had Wet Leg on. And I just thought, oh, that's who that was. That's where I got Prioritized Pleasure from, Self Esteem. So thank you for listening. My name is Maxwell Haddad. Peace. Okay, so I had to come on here and mention just one other thing. Mission Impossible 3 marks the very first appearance of Simon Pegg in the Mission Impossible universe. Now, I don't know the name of his character, but he's kind of like the nerdy gadgets guy. And he's perfect in that part. And I remember hearing a story, I guess it was around the time of Shaun of the Dead, because he got hired off of Shaun of the Dead, as far as I know. Mission Impossible 3 was 2006. So that's 2 years after Shaun of the Dead. Maybe his next movie, his next film appearance, I don't know. But released the year previous to Hot Fuzz. So he hadn't even been in Hot Fuzz yet when Mission Impossible 3 came out. Now, I didn't see Mission Impossible 3 when it came out. I was 16. I was in high school. It was a fucked up time for me. I wasn't interested in Mission Impossible movies at that time. Now I am, but at the time I wasn't. So, yeah, I'm seeing it now and I'm just kind of recounting this, remembering it, trying to stitch together the pieces, figure out what happened here. How did Simon Pegg end up in Mission Impossible? Not really. Basically, I heard this story once or something to this effect that, like, after Shaun of the Dead, Simon Pegg said, "Oh, I'm not going to go and do Mission Impossible 3," like as a joke. And then he gets a call from J.J. Abrams asking him if he wants to do Mission Impossible 3, something like that. I don't know, something to that effect. So, anyway, he's in the movie. He ended up in the movie, and he has been in every subsequent Mission Impossible movie in increasingly larger and more significant roles. I don't really know. I think that's what happened. And not, I shouldn't say roles. He's playing the same character, but it's just his part has gotten larger in each subsequent movie, and he's in each subsequent movie, or sequel, I think. I'm not sure. He was in Fallout, if I'm remembering correctly. And yeah, I think he's in all of them. I know he's in Ghost Protocol because he's in the screenshot that's on Amazon Prime video. So I know he's in that one. And yeah, I think he's part of the crew. So I think he's in all of them. So good for him, you know? Good for you, Simon Pegg. Just like his book said, nerd do well. And he has done well. Simon Pegg, I don't think has the best taste, though. I think he's done a lot of bad movies. He's made a lot of bad decisions, even as a writer. I think it's cool that he's written on a Star Trek movie and that he's part of. I think it's cool that he's part of two like kind of big cinematic universes now, Star Trek and Mission Impossible, and they're both cool franchises, and they've both been done well. And J.J. Abrams is involved in both, and they're also both based on cool 1960s television shows. So it's cool that he's part of both of them, that he's part of the Mission Impossible cinematic universe, if you like, the Miku. And he's also part of the Star Trek cinematic universe, so the Stiku, maybe. I don't know if that works. But I think that's cool. I think that it's cool that he's Scotty in Star Trek. He's kind of like the Scotty equivalent in Mission Impossible. That's cool. It works. He's like the comedic relief. He's the funny sidekick. You know, he's, you know, Ethan Hunt, played by Tom Cruise. He's kind of the straight man, the hero, the tough guy, the James Bond type, except with less womanizing. Philip Seymour Hoffman is actually more of a womanizer in this movie. He kind of flirts up Maggie Q a little bit in one scene. It's kind of funny to see Philip Seymour Hoffman flirting with a gorgeous woman. But also just kind of sad to see Philip Seymour Hoffman doing anything. Rest in peace.
Something else that I just wanted to mention briefly is that I'm drinking a putrid drink. I'm not actually drinking it, but I got a putrid drink for free, luckily, from the car place that I went to yesterday. I had to get a new battery yesterday because, as far as I know, I'd never gotten it replaced. This car is 10 years old and it still had the original battery in it. So I got a brand new one yesterday. I think I talked about it on yesterday's episode, but they had some free snacks and some free drinks there, which was a highlight of my day. And one of the free drinks that I got was Revive from Nestle Pure Life, which is, as it's described on the label, quote, or a quote, still water beverage with magnesium to help reduce tiredness and fatigue. It's lemon flavor with other natural flavors, contains no juice. Ingredients: purified water, magnesium sulfate, citric acid to maintain freshness. Natural flavors. That's not bad, actually. 35% magnesium, zero sodium, does not tell you the sugar content. I'm sure it's significant. When it says natural flavors, they're maybe talking about, oh, it says zero sugar, zero sweeteners. I don't know. It just has a really gross, weird flavor to it. And I would say my advice would be to steer clear of anything made by Nestle that isn't a Crunch bar. Peace.
Okay, just one more thing to add, I promise. Now, this is unsubstantiated, but I believe I have heard, or I think I've heard, it's possible I've made this up,
At this point, I don't know what's a memory. I don't know what I've made up, what I've written. But it is my understanding that Bruce Willis was, at one point in time, a bartender in Boston. So if that is true, then that's even more respect. Okay, I know. I know. I promised. Excuse me. But there is just one last thing. Back in 2010, a movie was released called Cop Out. It starred Bruce Willis and Tracy Morgan, and it was directed by Kevin Smith, not written by him. Now, the movie was originally called A Couple of Dicks, written by a writing team, I guess, and Kevin Smith became attached, was looking forward to working with Bruce Willis. I don't know what the whole story is. Anyway, it didn't work out. Bruce Willis was apparently a dick the entire time. He and Kevin Smith apparently butted heads the entire time. The movie ended up failing commercially and critically. And that was it for Kevin Smith, the director for Hire. He went back to making indie movies. Bruce Willis's career kind of faltered and never really recovered after that. Like I said, he did have a great year in 2012 with both Moonrise Kingdom and Looper. That was like his last great year. And then after that, he kind of just retreated into making Bruce Willis movies until his retirement, which was announced yesterday. So, on the set of Cop Out, apparently all sorts of fucked up shit happened involving Bruce Willis, and involving Bruce Willis being a total dick. And Kevin Smith has said that most of the stories, the worst stories, he can't tell until after Bruce Willis has died, and he hasn't died yet, but as soon as that happens, maybe Kevin Smith will come out with some stuff. I'm sure he could write a whole book about the making of Cop Out, but and that would be great. I don't think that'll ever happen, but that would be great. So yeah, and Kevin Smith did tweet about Bruce Willis retiring last night, saying that before all that Cop Out shit, I was just a Bruce Willis fan. So it was a respectful tweet, despite Kevin Smith hating Bruce Willis for the rest of his life, I'm sure. Anyway, so at one point, this was during, I think it was during one of the evening widths, with Kevin Smith before his heart attack, you know, pre all that, but post Cop Out, obviously. He decided to tell a story from the set of Cop Out. He said, "This is probably the worst story I can tell while Bruce Willis is still alive." Now, mind you, this didn't even sound that bad to me, to be honest. And I've worked with some dicks, so maybe that's why I'm not as affected by it as other people maybe were when they heard this story. Kevin Smith was apparently affected by it. I'll go into why I think he was affected by it. So, he's sitting on a stoop with Bruce Willis, and the crew is setting up inside. They're sitting out, sitting out on the stoop or whatever it is. And this car drives by, and these people in the car yell out. I guess they see Bruce Willis, and they yell out of the car, "Die Hard!" And they drive off. Bruce Willis doesn't say anything, doesn't react. Kevin Smith, I don't know, I guess kind of looks at the car and it drives away and that's it. But then Bruce Willis, this is how I'm remembering it. I haven't heard the story in years, but this is how I'm remembering it. Bruce Willis, without looking at Kevin Smith, says, "I hate the ones that yell Die Hard the most." He either said that or he said, "I hate the ones who yell Die Hard the most." And he said, Kevin Smith, he basically said, like, "I'll never forget that." Like, he was just so horrible to him. Now, like I said, that doesn't sound that bad to me. That sounds pretty mild. It almost sounds like Bruce Willis was half joking, although apparently he said it, like, completely seriously. What I think fucked Kevin Smith up about it was that, and apparently that's just the tip of the iceberg, but apparently all the other stories are, like, too fucked up for Kevin Smith to tell while Bruce Willis is alive. Like, that's how fucked up the experience was working with him. That's how horrible he was. But he said that's probably like the worst story that I can tell while he's alive, and that's really not even that bad to me. But I think for Kevin Smith that was like really bad because
or to him, that came across as horrible behavior, because Kevin Smith loves his fans and he appreciates his fans, and he says, you know, I wouldn't be here without my fans, you know, that kind of thing. He's like very kind of like supportive of his fans. So for Bruce Willis to just ignore these guys driving by and then to say, I hate the ones who yell Die Hard the most, which is like, yeah, I mean, it's basically like the most negative thing he could have said in that situation. And it is fucking, it is terrible. But I don't know. To me, it actually doesn't seem that bad. But I'm also jaded. I have a thick skin. People have treated me like shit my entire life. I've worked on sets. Everybody was horrible to me on the set. I was literally treated like shit. I was treated like a slave. So, like, for Bruce Willis to just, like, make a flippant comment, it just, like, it really doesn't seem that bad to me. But I can see where Kevin Smith is coming from. Like, wow, this guy is, like, actually a bad person. Like, not only does he, like, not appreciate the fact that he's rich and famous, he's actually, like, talking shit about his own fans to the point that he's saying he hates them the most. The ones who say Die Hard, the movie that made his career. It is really fucked up. I mean, I understand what Kevin Smith is saying. It is really fucked up if you think about it. But at the end of the day, I do think it's kind of funny. I do think the whole story is kind of funny. And I mean, part of that is, like, the fact that Kevin Smith told it, and all Kevin Smith stories are funny to one extent or another. Especially the way he tells them. But it also, yeah, I don't know, maybe illustrates where Bruce Willis was at that time in terms of his career, in terms of his mental health. I mean, what nobody knew is that he had aphasia, but that probably didn't come about until later. Or maybe not, I don't know. Maybe that's why he came across, one of the reasons why he came across that way is that he had aphasia. I have no idea, and I'm not defending him, and I'm certainly not a doctor. But I do love Bruce Willis even more than I love Kevin Smith, actually. No joke. And I am sad that he's retired, and I will continue to discuss him on the podcast, I'm sure. So thank you for listening. Talk to you soon. Peace.